From the front lines of youth advocacy to the boardrooms of billion-dollar impact initiatives, Jan Owen has challenged the way society sees young people, not as problems to be fixed, but as powerhouses of creativity, leadership, and change.
Power is finite, and you get pretty quickly to relevance deprivation syndrome. Just talk to any politician in the world.
This isn't just a story about leadership. It's a story about legacy.
Jan Owen, welcome to The Global Affair.
Thank you.
I'm really looking forward to this conversation because I got to be on your, well, it wasn't a podcast, but I got to be interviewed by you just over a week ago, and what was meant to be an hour turned into 3 hours. And we went down many important routes of conversation. So I felt that, you know, it was my turn to host you, and maybe we could finish off some of those open tabs on The Global Affair and bring all of our listeners on that journey with us.
It's only fair. It was only fair that we come back around.
Exactly. So for anyone that's new to The Global Affair, this is a space where we get to talk about the most contentious issues of our time, but we try to do that in an emotionally regulated way. And that's core to my leadership ethos. And I just want to say, Jan, which I think I've mentioned a few times to you recently, the ways that you and your work really shaped me as a young entrepreneur, and watching someone, you know, in a position of influence and power that I could really see myself in was quite a profound experience for me. And I know a lot of other young, especially I think female leaders who I met around the Foundation for Young Australians, which you were the CEO of at the time. This is going back, you know, 15 years when I did the Young Social Pioneers program. And then this amazing journey of our paths, you know, relinking in an unlikely way, which is through the wellness and longevity space. Jan is the founder and CEO of a longevity clinic called Be Well, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But I know that there's such a dynamic story there. I'd love you, Jan, just to summarize what you feel your core life mission is.
Great question.
In simple terms, and then we can unpack it.
Simple terms. You know, it took me ages to think about this because I think I've had many core life missions, which I think is okay, by the way, and probably important. Because the one thing that I'm not is kind of static, and which is kind of interesting because I set up a company 6 years ago when I left FIA called Adaptability Q, and I wanted to explore the adaptability quotient, which I've kind of done all my life and I continue to do in many ways. And so the fact that I set up a business called that, and you know, I think that's very core to me. But within that, I think I have really core values that guide me, and have since I was very, very, very small. I think the world has changed around those and calibrated them, but I think the core values of kind of our common humanity, which of course is you know, in a very interesting place at the moment. I think the core values of kind of equity and equality, and I think the kind of core values of generosity have always been, you know, kind of very, very, very kind of in my DNA. And I believe in DNA kind of not just in the physical kind of that I believe in it in an ancestral kind of way. So I understand that it has come from deep ancestral roots, not to mention somebody, a clairvoyant once telling me that I was burnt at the stake for being a witch, which makes exact sense because I would have been that sort of person that would have been burnt at the stake for becoming a witch. And fire is, there's nothing in me that loves fire in any way, shape or form. I'm not even good around a campfire.
So, oh, wow. Not even telling stories around a campfire.
Not even. Yeah.
I think this is a you know, fascinating insight into you, Jan. And I know you came from a family of people that were passionate about social advocacy. Maybe you can bring us into, you know, those early days and then how they defined the leader that you became through your adult years and are today.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, I've often talked about how my family helped set up Lifeline in Australia, which is obviously, you know, now a global entity was set up in every country. But in those days when Lifeline was set up, my parents were sitting at like a desk like this. This is like their after hours thing, by the way. It wasn't their job.
What was their day job?
My dad was a very serious, he was an academic. He helped actually create sunscreen. So he was a mathematician, a physicist, a pharmacist, a chemist. He helped Hewlett Packard with building the very first computers. He was a very eclectic, almost a polymath, like just very, very interesting guy. And so this was what they did, like outside of his work. My mum was mostly at home, although she'd studied literature and stuff, so she had a very, very passionate commitment to reading and writing and stuff like that. They're sort of opposites, I guess, in that way. But were also involved in community and in church and stuff. And so Lifeline came about because of that. And so I distinctly remember being a really little kid and sitting kind of under the desk while they were taking phone calls. And in those days, you took the phone call for a crisis, you put the phone down, you went and got in the car and drove to where the crisis was. And wow. You then counseled people. So I was in the car because, I was like eight and I have three brothers and an older sister. So all of us, like everybody goes to the crisis as small children. And so I watched my dad literally talk people from jumping off the Story Bridge in Brisbane, which is one of the biggest bridges. Or I watched my parents walk into a full-blown domestic violence crisis in a home in the suburbs with the police standing outside saying this is a personal issue and nothing to do with us, while my parents went in and came out with mothers and children. Those children and mothers would often come and stay at our place, so all the beds would be rearranged and the lounge room, and we didn't have a big place. And often the mothers would go away and get kind of set up and then come leave their children with us. And this was really before the formal system of foster care and everything came into being.
Really? So back then there was no actual foster care system?
There was there was children's homes.
Wow.
Which is the worst and last place you would ever want to be. And that was if you were like actually an orphan or you've been abandoned. But these were not, these were women who were experienced domestic violence, and there were no laws about that like there are now. And so I learned really, really early one fundamental life kind of thing, which was sort of life lesson, which was you could reset, you could start again no matter what had happened to you. And I think that really, even as an entrepreneur, I think that really kind of went deep into my psyche, because these women would come back. They would have got back on their feet, they'd have found somewhere to live, and they'd get their children and go back and kind of get on with their life. Not everybody, obviously some people in sort of cycles of violence, but so many just needed the break and they needed somebody, please look after my children while I go and sort myself out. And Lifeline would also help them do that. So it was amazing. And that whole idea that community could look after itself, that you could reset and you could restart at any point, no matter what had happened to you, these just dug deep into my psyche, and I kind of really have carried those through as then being a little tiny kidpreneur as I was doing crazy, the crazy.
What were those early hustles like, 10?
Lemonade stand. 12. Lemonade stand was my first. I had lemonade stand at the top of my driveway. I lived like 35 minutes from a city. Two cars went past my driveway every day. One of them was my dad, and I sold him a lemonade every day. And I stuck with it, Nick, even though there were only two cars a day and one was my dad.
The true entrepreneurial spirit.
As somebody said to me recently, hope is not a strategy, and that's what I was doing then. I was so I then went on to a whole bunch of stuff. I was like fixing up bikes. I caught toads. I set up Toads Inc. for a while, where in Queensland, where I grew up, toads were like endemic, and my family had beehives. We had a million. My dad was, as I said, this like amazing inventor kind of person. So we always had a new project on the go. And at one point we had, 100 beehives until my brother became allergic and nearly died about three times after being rushed to hospital after being stung. But for a while there, toads sit outside hives. They love bees, and at night they eat them, which is not good for the beehive, you know, community, let alone the honey trying to get. So I set up a business where I would, with my three brothers, I employed them to come and catch the toads. And then we take them to the university up the road, which was the veterinary university, and then we could sell them to the vet students. It's disgusting, but that's how, you know, you test
them. What would they buy toads for back then?
Well, back then it was like 50 cents a toad if it was alive. So it had to be alive. So I had to make my mum drive the live toads in a tin while they're bouncing at the top of the tin to the university every day. So I obviously, because it was my idea and I was the CEO, and I held the torch, and my brothers had to actually catch the toads.
You were directing the operation.
Yeah. I obviously got the most money, and they got enough money to buy, you know, little packets of sweets. So I learned really early on about, you know, setting up a business, working out what my role was, which is sort of marketing, sales, convincing my brothers, and finding the market. And I also learned how to deal with boys really early. So I had three younger brothers that were like a year apart, and I was like,
you were the oldest.
I was the oldest. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. How much older than the second, like your oldest brother?
My brother, so I have a sister who's 5 years older than me, and so she was right out of it. She was like, you're like a kind of a hurricane cult, you four, and I'm staying as far away from you as I possibly can because you might infect me. And also she was the natural child of my parents. We were all adopted, so we were also slightly kind of weird and wonderful or not so wonderful. And then my next brother's 18 months younger than me, and then the next one 12, and the next one 12 months. So we were a formidable pack. We used to go into a shopping center with my mother, like into our local shops, and the shop owners would literally say to her, could you leave the children outside, like dogs, could you leave the children outside? Because anytime we went, it would be chaos. Like my brothers were perfect at, you know, pulling down the middle tin of a pyramid of, you know, tin tomatoes and just watching the chaos. It's like, what would happen if we did this? Well, what happens is that your mother gets banned from ever shopping in that shop ever again.
You were just checking out what stock you could bring to your lemonade stand to improve the improve the sales cycle.
Curious about, you know, design and
this makes a lot of sense. Okay, and then what about like leaving home for the first time? And Create was your first venture, right? Your first non-lemonade stand pursuit.
Yeah. I think I would have left home much earlier, but my dad died when I was like 19 or 20, suddenly of a heart attack, which was incredibly stressful. He was like 53, which is hard to imagine now because I'm past 53. But it's it was a very, very big shock. My brothers were still teenagers. My mother was kind of left with these five children. She had not worked because of that kind of era that she was, you know, bringing kids up in the 60s and 70s. And so she had to go back to work, and it was just, you know, so there were many, I would have probably left by then because I kind of was of course, like everyone who's entrepreneurial, is a high school dropout several times over. But I kind of prided myself on going to school at the least possible days I possibly could in senior secondary. And, you know, had been expelled and suspended from a couple of schools. But I probably would have gone and hit the road or, you know, gone interstate, any number of things. But because my dad died, I felt really, really felt for my mum, and I really felt for her with these three, like, insane sort of brothers that really needed a father, to be honest. Yeah. And so I stayed around until I was, you know, in my early 20s. And I started working I just went straight to work pretty much and started working on drug and alcohol education and working in a city where there were concentrations of people with, you know, not inner city gentrified as it is today, but inner city where there were concentrated people living in poverty, people who, First Nations people particularly as well in Brisbane, who'd come down from missions and stations and just started working, with children and young people and families, which was amazing. And also doing a lot of guerrilla entrepreneurship. We used to take over disused service stations and turn them into big drop-in centres and then write to companies and tell them what we'd done, send them photos and say, this is awesome PR for you. And by the way, we broke into your
service station. Like squatting for social change. Wow.
Squatting, bit of guerrilla entrepreneurship, as they used to call it back then. I was sort of still always doing that stuff then. And then when I finally left, I'd got involved in sort of national youth politics and advocacy, and I was president and chair of a couple of big kind of youth advocacy organisations that were working with government. So I kind of hit the road and went to Melbourne and Sydney and, you know, started doing the loop, I guess, which was good.
How did you find, you're obviously a big Melbourne advocate. When you went to Melbourne in those early years, did you have a feeling like, yeah, this is where I'm going to be?
Well, you know, I was actually born in Melbourne. So I was born in Melbourne. My parents were living in Melbourne at the time that I was adopted. I think I was lounging around in a hospital somewhere and my parents...
Lounging around, waiting for
a baby. And my parents picked me up out of the baby lineup, and then a couple of years later we went to Brisbane. I remembered Melbourne because I started like prep in Melbourne, and so I kind of had a good, I don't know. And then when I came back, and I've only been back, I mean, I was in and out of Melbourne a lot, but when I finally came back, which is now 15 years ago, which is hard to believe, I landed and I just thought, oh, I found my home, like I've really found my home and my people are here. I just felt like this very, Melbourne has always been the progressive place in Australia, also the best food, the best coffee, you know, the European weather. It's our European city in Australia, right? So I just always loved that.
Wow, so... This early pursuit for you was obviously inspired by what you witnessed your parents creating through Lifeline. What about your father's passing? How much did that grief play a role in shaping your direction?
I mean, weirdly, I think I was so, I was 19 or so. I was pretty into what I was doing. I think I found, and also my father was a workaholic. So, I was very close to him. I was sort of, I was quite close to him at different points in my life. But probably when he died, I was probably sort of getting into my own sort of space and finding my own way. And I was probably less kind of connected into him in that way. He'd also been very, very sick and hospitalized for a year when I was 16, I was in year 11 and 12. And I think I kind of went through almost like a separation then because he nearly died several times. And so I felt a lot at that point. But I didn't have the language. I didn't have the way of being able to express it. It was really sort of tough at 16, I think. So I think I was, I don't know that I was ready for what happened, but I think I was sort of in this kind of different place by the time he died. And it was only years later. Also, as I found out a lot more about him, it's weird how much you don't know about your parents when you're young. It's actually years later in your 20s.
Probably for the best.
Sometimes definitely for the best. But, in my 20s and 30s, I started to find out more about him, not even from my mother, just from other people. I went to the University of Queensland once where he was like this kind of guy, and I was going to, I don't know, maybe his faculty, and somebody stopped me. I must have asked about him or something, and this young kind of PhD kind of student said, oh, my God, was that your dad? I mean, that person had the most profound influence on my entire career. as a young person who'd come, I think they maybe had come to study from Southeast Asia or anyway, it was like, I was like, oh, wow, I did not know that. So, you know, I just discovered all these things over time way after the fact, which is so weird because I obviously probably would have loved to, you know, at that time later, I would have loved to talk to my dad about all those things. So,
yeah,
sort of interesting loss, but also, you know, kind of finding out afterwards, which is awesome. And I talk about, you know, I talk about both my parents have died, that I was sort of orphaned twice by the time I was 35 or something. So probably talked about them a lot more since they died than when they were alive, actually.
Yeah, you know, in so many ways that makes a huge amount of sense. And how much do you feel that being adopted defines you? Like, is that something that you feel is kind of core to your point of view and the way you see life?
Very, very, very much so. Very much so. Right from the beginning, because I think you always feel separate in some way to the people that you're with, no matter how much your parents love you, and our parents did love us. There's narratives that flow over from their own sense of who they are as having adopted you. There's narratives that flow from extended family, and there were many narratives in the extended family about these kind of runt litter children. There are many narratives that just flow from overheard conversations to things that are said directly to you. It's been a very powerful. And then, of course, like everyone, and this is why I ended up working with children and young people in care, obviously, for a large part of my sort of early years and career, was the first thing that you do as soon as you can is try to work out who are my parents and where are they? Because that information is never, ever, ever provided. So I spent a bunch of years trying to find my natural parents, my biological parents, who they were. And then I found out all that, and that also kind of reshaped me because it also made a heap of other things make sense. And although I didn't meet either of them because they both, one didn't want to meet me and the other, my mother had died by the time I sort of found her family and her best friends. The recognition when I met that family who said, oh, my God, you look like your mother, you sound like your mother, and like oh, wow, that's amazing. It's quite a strange, you know, it's a really strange thing to be confronted with that kind of your DNA. You laugh like your mother. Well, that's interesting. And then my father was heavily involved in the kind of justice system and law, and then I kind of realized why and where probably a whole heap of that came from as well for me.
Yeah. So you actually connected with, after your mom had passed and you discovered where she was from, you connected with her world, like her friends, her
family.
Any biological siblings?
No. And I was like a deathbed confession.
The
only person who really knew about me was her best friend who came to Melbourne with her when she had me.
That just gave me chills. Like, I'm just imagining what it would have been like for her, your mom's best friend, to meet you. And
yeah, it was amazing. It was great.
And, you know, did you feel your mom's love through the way her best friend reacted to you when you first connected?
No, I didn't. And I felt, you know, and this is when then you end up in years of therapy, right? Because my mother's best friend said that, you know, my biological mother didn't want to see me. And you can imagine like lots and lots of reasons why, because and that she had been, you know, her hand was forced to actually give me up. She didn't want to give me up at all. And so she told her best friend to see me so that she wouldn't, but she would have somebody who'd see me. So that was interesting. And the best friend felt it like a huge thing to be the person that had seen me and had to kind of do the goodbye on behalf of my biological mother.
It's so fascinating to learn, you know, all these things in this level of detail, about you, Jan, and I know one of the things that we spoke about in the last interview was the sense of like place, you know, and our lineage and our sense of place and how that defines us and the way we orient the world. And I think for entrepreneurs and leaders, how we choose to lead. And this is kind of my deeper curiosity in the context of the conversation I wanted to have with you today, how this has oriented you in your leadership. You know, I know one of the things you infamously talk about is the power love money triangle, right? Mm-hmm. And I actually remember the moment that you said that to me for the first time, and I think it was probably around 2014, 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, back then I was thinking about starting a for-profit business, and you probably delayed that for me a good 5 years. I stuck on the.
Oh my God. Have you forgiven me for that or not?
Absolutely. I was actually going to honor it and say, I think that having those, and by the way, I've reflected with like other tribe members from those years about how powerful those roots were to have actual elders. Because as we know, like in our society, you know, and even in your story, not having elders in the form of your own, you know, lineage and your own family to actually help you figure yourself out and understand what your values are in the world. And especially an entrepreneur who has the chance of inheriting substantial amounts of influence, right? What do you want that influence to be about? Do you want it to be about love, power, or money? And yeah, we were standing in the corridor in FYA, and I can't remember what I had shared with you, but you drew it out for me. And I, you know, for me then and still, the obvious choice is that love is my North Star. Mm-hmm. But I've also had this, you know, fascination with understanding the power dynamics of our world and the way that money, you know, people say that money changes people. I think money magnifies people. I think money is a magnifying glass. It puts it puts a giant magnifying glass over who you already were and exaggerates the person that you already were before you had money. And like I'm curious around how you reflect on these things in the context of your entrepreneurial journey and maybe the challenges you had around finding your sense of belonging in the world early on.
I think I also always find the leader sort of moniker attached to me is sort of weird and interesting, although I was, and these are again early influences, right? So when I think I was like 12 or something, and I was sort of transitioning from primary school to high school. And I think I was sort of all right in primary school. It was high school that undid me, as it does many a student.
And many an entrepreneur.
Many an entrepreneur, yeah. Or many a person with any kind of learning. Like
intelligence.
I think that somebody pulled my parents aside and said, you know, Jan is actually like a really genuine leader. Like people will follow her and she motivates people. And my parents were obviously like, what are you talking about? This little rat pack kid that we doesn't do anything that she's told, when she's told how she's told, like, you know.
Yeah.
And even I was like, whatever. But I always think that the entrepreneurial thing in me is actually that if a leader is a kind of a requirement of being an entrepreneur, it's the entrepreneurial kind of DNA has always been so like the primary focus for me. But then it was, and I've often thought, because I found out, of course, in my biological family, yes, on my father's side it was law and justice and the system, and on my mother's side it was all business. So I often like think about, wow, what if I had stayed in that family? Would I have been a business entrepreneur rather than a social entrepreneur? But the family that I was adopted into was socially minded and community minded. And so social entrepreneurship was so, I find it sort of, you know, these are sliding doors and paths, and I have no idea. But I do know that the three currencies of money, love, and power are very real and very writ large in the world, and that loved and that you need to be, and I would have said this to you, you need to wear all of them. You need to put the clothes on of all of them. And yeah. also you need to know essentially like where, and, you know, I would hope that love drives everyone. It definitely drives me in community. But it also could be because of my lived experience that I had to build community, that I built my family, that I've anybody who has ever been kind of disconnected from people or community or love, it's mm. always a lightning rod to me, as you know, like bring yeah. them in. Don't worry, you've got a home with me is kind of my, you know, my, and that's always been the case for me. Yeah. And why I've got so many amazing, you know, still young people, older people, all kinds of people that, because you build and you create your community. But love has been my central premise, but I understand power and I've been in it a lot, as have you, and played in that space. And I understand money, but I know that my driver out of those three currencies is love, and community is what is represented by love. So it's sort of a no-brainer for me, and I think it always has been. My mates, you know, when I was at Social Ventures Australia and helping set that up for, you know, 9 years, and there's a lot of kind of corporate refugees there and expats and stuff, and they would always say,
trying to find meaning. Was that the
redemption, meaning, all the things? And they would always say to me, you know, Michael Trail, who I, you know, super close to and still am today, would always say, like, you kind of, you know, he kind of had it in his DNA because of his family, but he's like, you know, you were kind of born with this thing that the rest of us have had to discover. And so you're really lucky, Jen.
But a bit of a naive way of saying, you know, you go through enough in life and you meet yourself and what your priorities are, right? And it's, do you believe that? Do you genuinely believe that that was nature more than nurture in yourself?
Well, if I think about, I don't know.
It's both.
I don't know. It's and, of course, it's and. It's not either or.
Yeah.
And I'm very aware of mystery, you know. I know how much we don't know.
The great mystery.
I don't know how much we don't know. I agree. I believe deeply in mystery. I have no idea. I believe deeply in ancestors. I believe deeply in intergenerational, you know, everything, trauma, wounds, but also genius and magic and, you know, I fundamentally believe that we are, you know, spiritual beings having a human experience, not human beings having a spiritual experience.
No, my next question for you was actually going to be to, I'm just making some notes so I don't forget, to circle back to you sharing that your adopted family was quite shaped by religion mm-hmm. and the ways in which that, you know, it's obvious, I think, to anyone that has a sense of spirituality being in your presence, there's a deep spirituality. And I'm curious to know how you understand that, or if you've tried to, you know, decode what that means for you, or if it's more just an isness.
Well, I think I went through the classic, right? I had a very, very strict Christian upbringing, like very strict.
What kind of Christianity?
Like, you know, Protestant, you know, and I went to a Catholic school and I had a Protestant upbringing and we went to church many times a day. And I really tried to be a good Christian. Like I really did. I tried really hard. I like an epic failure at it.
Are you a believer fundamentally?
I'm a believer in more than what we can see, touch, feel, understand. You know, what in whatever way. And, I've spent a lot of time in Eastern, you know, practices over many years now in terms of meditation and, you know, Hinduism. And so I kind of want all of it. I want it all as a
kind unified of pill.
Feast, right? It's a feast, not a famine. Like I refuse to be kind of locked into one position or one worldview or one belief system. I genuinely, I'm just very intrigued by spirituality at that broader level and how we how we meet our divinity. What is that? What does that look like? What does that feel like? How do you know when you've reaching your divinity? And hopefully it's not just when you die and you kind of transition to something else, but
DMT, you know, is released in your brain. And
there was, you know, the only biblical thing that I really liked that I learned was this whole idea that, you know, God is within you, not outside of you. So, you know, you pray to the God within you, which is also a mantra, you know, in Buddhism and Hinduism. So there's these common themes across Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, and they're the things that I'm interested in. I'm interested in what are the common elements that, and this idea that God is, that you have divinity within you and God is within you, not external to you, really, really resonates with me at a very deep level.
Yeah, not an authority that's judging you on the external. And have you ever journeyed a fear of God, going through that sort of upbringing and then, you know, coming into what sounds like your own liberation?
No, I'm 100% rebellious, Nick.
100%.
Fear God. What are you talking about? God.
Well, it's an intense upbringing, you know, to go to
But I was so rebellious in my upbringing in every element of it. I was never that person who was like, I'm scared that, you know, God's going to strike me down or anything. I was like, no, God does not have that sort of power over me. That's probably pretty much my worldview back then. Much more nuanced now. But yeah, no, I was never. I mean, my parents did try to put the fear of God in me all the time. I mean, I more than once I was prayed over, had ministerial visits and, you know, trying to exorcise evil out of me, which the evil was, by the way, you know, that I, you know, probably slept with a boy or something. You know, it was like that kind of
crazy.
That kind of evil, you know. Smoke some weed, like, you know, there's all definitions of evil are very different depending on what your benchmark is.
How evil you are, yeah. Okay. Agree. I find this fascinating, though, and I have similar perspectives. Like I do in Christian language believe that the kingdom of heaven is within, you know, and that if you sit with yourself long enough, that's actually the only way really to reach a transcendent place. If you can't be with yourself in your totality, you're always going to be running away from this sense of wholeness. And that actually that journey is about self-integration. And I think, when you go on that journey, it creates a sense of devotion, which I can imagine really shaped your love-based perspective on leadership, because you recognize that everything else is really a chase, right? It's you can never have enough money. You can never have enough power. If that's the chase that you're chasing. Yeah, and, you know,
that's true.
You can also never have enough love, but I think that that's probably a better thing to be not having enough of and wanting more of, right?
Think it's, can you never not have enough love, or can you never, like, love? I mean, love is an endless thing that you
that's
can,
what I mean. It's infinite.
It's like it's
there's infinite. Always more. There's always more.
You can always
there's always more. And
whereas the others are finite, as you say, power is finite, and you get pretty quickly to relevance deprivation syndrome. Just talk to any politician in the world. And then money is also very temporal. You can't take it with you.
Yeah,
the richest people are the seemingly the unhappiest people. are their children, because it just seems that it's so purposeless and valueless. So, you know, I sort of fantasize about being that person who, if I did ever have a lot of money, I would be, you know, kind of philanthropy would be my thing. And that would be, you know, that's my ultimate goal, is to be a philanthropist.
Yeah, makes sense.
To, you know, the like art,
social entrepreneurship causes to get behind. Yeah,
100%. Like genuinely, and double down, you know, and stay for the long haul. All the things I wish philanthropy would do are the things that I would do. It's very judgmental of me, because obviously there is good philanthropy out there, but.
Yeah, a shortage of it. I take your point. I mean, we see it in tech that wants to sort of have more of an ethical foundation, that the investment cycles are 5-year returns, and it's very, very hard to have any kind of ethical considerations if that's the impetus, you know. So it's needed. And I, what I want to say to that is, it's not too late. I think you will get there, actually, Jen. Don't know how, but can't tell you how, but that's part of the mystery.
I better start buying shares in your company. Yeah.
Well, that's it. We can build in truth, and then that can be the
That would be a good start.
Philanthropy for the next 7 generations forward. Together. Yeah.
it's intriguing to me because, you know, it takes 10 years to build every company really properly, and yet in philanthropy it's like, oh, I'm going to give for 1 year or 2 years or 3 years. Like, it's the exact diametrical opposite of what people have done to build the wealth, unless they're, you know, trust kids.
It's so
bizarre to me that we have, and it's still the same. I see it all the time. We still have this very strong disconnect. Like, people go into philanthropy, I'm going to do good and I'm going to give away some of my money, but the thought processes and the ways that they approach their business are not what they bring to philanthropy. They don't bring that patience. They don't bring that kind of care. They don't bring that kind of chutzpah, they don't bring the kind of sweat. Like, it's so weird to me how people transform with money. It's just very, it's very strange and very curious.
I really understand what you're saying, and we could do a whole podcast on that because I have a lot of views on why actually values-based money is needed right now more than it's ever been, because the decisions we're making, the companies we're building, is shaping the next 1,000 years, and that's unprecedented. I know one could argue that was always true, but the technologies that elevate today truly will build, you know, the next bureaucratic structures, economic structures, every kind of system you can imagine is about to be overturned. But that would be taking the podcast in a radical different direction, and we'll be here until 5 p.m. if we start solving those problems. So let's just put a pin in that. You had an amazing career, obviously, at Social Ventures Australia, which you've mentioned, and I would encourage anyone to go and look at Jan's very extensive kind of professional background, because we're not going to be able to touch on it all in this episode. Maybe we can do a part two. But when you started, when you were asked, tapped on the shoulder and asked to become the CEO of FYA, Jen, what was going on for you at that time?
Well, I'd done, you know, two kind of startups and I tend to have chapters. I'm intrigued about, again, exactly for that rate of speed of change, Nick, but also the fact that I know that, you know, every garage band that wasn't an overnight success was 10 years singing pubs, and every business really, no matter even when you talk to the unicorns, they still say it was 10 years before we got to the place. You know, yes, there are some random unicorns that pop up and sell their product very quickly to another group that actually spend the 10 years, but this sort of theme. And so I've always had these chapters of sort of 6 years when I then either kind of bring in a new enterprise into the thing I'm doing, which has happened many times over, and that keeps me going for like another 3 years. So it's almost like I do 3-3-3 inside a kind of a chapter. And I've really kind of loved that, which is strange because normally you'd think an entrepreneur would just keep moving, but I kind of build inside the build, which I think has been fascinating and really interesting and a good way to grow things, because you've got the infrastructure, you've got the team, you've got the people, you've also got the trust of investors and people. So I did the few years, 9 years or whatever, at Create to set up, you know, the first kind of advocacy, young people led organization for young people in out-of-home care in Australia. I then went on to Social Ventures Australia, which was bringing, you know, business skills and acumen to the social sort of sector to help accelerate growth and change. And really those two things came together at FIA for me, because I thought, I know about all the kinds of things that young people are going through and the kind of those who are marginalized, but also about the issues. At SVA, I got my MBA live, really, over that 8 years. I just literally got a live MBA. I just worked constantly with ex-management consultants from the top tier companies, ex-bankers, ex-investors, you know, like there was just, it was a hot house of like really, really smart people. And I just literally soaked it up like a sponge. And then I brought it all together at FIA. I thought, well, with the kind of business thinking and acumen and with the kind of focus on social issues and innovation and what needs to change now and putting young people in the driver's seat of that, let's go.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. We just put our foot on the accelerator and went.
And that's exactly what was created, right? That the FIA office was, you know, was always like the vibe was palpable always. Mm. And it did become that community, that ecosystem. And I'm sure over the however long was it, 5, 6, 7 years that you were
eight and a half years, yeah.
Wow, yeah, okay. So it has been a lot of years. But almost 9 years that you sat in the CEO seat, you would have met thousands of young entrepreneurs during that time. And you know, one of the questions I had for you today was, with that consistent exposure to young talent, how was your kind of process of being able to, or maybe a different way of asking it is, were the success stories young entrepreneurs that you could pick kind of in the first few seconds?
What a good question. No, not at all. I got it wrong so many times. Well, no, I didn't get it wrong. There's no wrong, by the way. Like working with young people, everything's right in my view. Everybody's where they're meant to be doing what they're meant to be doing. So that's like that's just a given. And so everybody who walks through the door, and remember that there were
no favorite children.
Yeah, there's no favorite children. Yeah. Remember that there were, I think it ended up being 500 to 600 young social pioneers through the kind of, which was the premium program in the country, the only one of its kind. A lot was spawned after that, which was awesome, but it was the program for 18 to 28 year olds basically in the country. And then we also introduced $20 Boss into high school, middle high, and there's another 60,000 young people that we trained in entrepreneurship for people, profit, planet and purpose by the time I left. So my view was that there would always be like, there would have been a million by the time I calculated the impact and ROI, there was like a million young people in that generation, Gen Y heading into Gen Z, that FIA had kind of given rocket fuel to.
Yeah.
Basically to their ideas, to their confidence, to their net, particularly their network. And you know that I was obsessed with that. I was a girl who came from like country Brisbane. And I arrived in Sydney and Melbourne and I was like, who are all these people? Who are all these networks? Where did they come from? And then I found out that people are still friends with people they went to primary school with, which is definitely not really what happened very much in Brisbane. So that whole, you know, build the network, build the ecosystem. And my mantra was, you will all know each other in 10, 20, 30, 40 years time. It doesn't matter if you didn't go to Cranbrook or Melbourne Grammar, like stuff it. You'll know each other. You'll have each other's backs. And pretty much to a person, you know, all day, every day, all I see on LinkedIn and all I see in the political environment in social change around Australia right now are those people.
Incredible. What does that make you feel?
It makes me feel so happy for Australia. So happy. And the world, actually. I just feel so, and I feel so privileged that I knew these people, because, of course, the other thing that I tracked was that as I was going through that process, and remember I came to FIA, I was like in my late 40s, so I was pretty old actually compared to everybody I was working with. But because I've had this sort of growth beginner mindset my whole life.
Always a very young spirit though.
I was always like Gen Y, like I'm a Gen Y-er in an ex-boomer body. Or whatever. But I was tracking my peers and watching them kind of, I don't know, get stuck and like have existential crises and like do all these things. And I'm like, I'm having the best time of my life. I am being mentored and mentoring. I'm in a reverse program with hundreds of amazing, you know, like 16 year ups to 30 year olds. It's like, this is nirvana. Like, this is it. And I honestly felt like I always said, and I still say, if you want to find out what's going to come next, go and talk to young people. Go talk to them about what's coming next. Everything I went to FIA with, all my mindsets were like blowing like 10x'd. And then it's also stayed with me, all those things I went in thinking that were like absolutely evidenced in 100 million different ways every day. And then out the other side, I still carry it, and I'm still, you know, just I feel different. It's just because I've always felt different in my whole life in every context, Nick. Yeah. But I still feel kind of different to my peers. Like I just do. It's so interesting to me.
Well, that was the power. I can tell you that objectively, you know. And I know that this entire generation would agree. And you're 100% right. There was a awakening and a vortex that allowed people that had really a lot of potential but didn't have the representation and the support to really know what to do with that. Mm. Gave them a focal point to actually be able to bring that to fruition and start their journey. Like, I remember I had so many people at 18 when I started my foundation tell me, just do it, you know, in 15 years. Go and get some experience first and
get a real job. First.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think I personally wouldn't have succumbed to that because, like you, I was way too rebellious. I'm unemployable, basically. Unemployable. I've never had a real boss.
Right.
But, you know, that was definitely the leading perspective. And now in my 30s, I'm so fucking grateful that I started at 18 because, you know, what I had to do to get that foundation off the ground, I don't think, like, I wouldn't have had even the energy to do it in my 30s. You know, I was willing to get up at 3:30 a.m. and get the Rex flight to the regional community and then facilitate workshops for 15 hours and sleep 5 hours and do it again. There was only one time in my life that I could have done that work. Yeah. And I'm so grateful that I was empowered, you know, to do that. And the journey that's taken me on is like profound. And I know that that's one of a million stories that were created because of the work that you and, you know, really the whole team at FYA contributed to.
It was an amazing team. Amazing, amazing, amazing team who are also, you know, half of them are entrepreneurs. Also, you know, they've all moved on to incredible careers, most of them as well in other places or setting up their own thing. So I think that whole idea that you can incubate a kind of a mindset and you can incubate a kind of a way of thinking and working and a way of being that is actually very real for people and enables them to sort of step into a kind of a lane, get into the vortex is I think people don't really understand that you can create and build that. And I think it's amazing when you see it. I think every single school should be like that, and it's not. You know, it doesn't. Yeah, schools don't have the autonomy and the mindsets and opportunity to be and to create that, except very, you know, there's some unique, wonderful schools that do that around the world, but it's way too limited, way too rare for the number of young people and children who need vastly different experiences of education and learning, particularly today, right?
Yeah, there's some interesting points you just made that I want to unpack further. Like, we have a lot of entrepreneurs that listen to this show, right? And I think one of the things that you modeled extremely amazingly was the power of creating a community that came together on a set of shared mindsets and values and a sense of purpose, and the power that then created to put rocket fuel behind FYA as a nonprofit, but also all of the businesses that we had started and were growing. And really, that's a very community-centric model, which when you look at a lot of strategies that entrepreneurs employ, it's somewhat the opposite. It's to try to, you know, reduce a product and service down to a very specific, you know, avatar, and it's not about community at all. And there was this kind of, you know, this anti-traditional marketing that allowed this whole kind of movement to grow. And I think that there's a powerful lesson in there for a lot of entrepreneurs. And, you know, in tech, a lot of people will say, if you want to build the next Apple, what you actually have to create is a cult. And so it's kind of, it's known at the highest levels, you know, that this, what you're touching on and what you incubated, actually is the magic that builds entire movements, that builds, you know, something that is powerful and like can actually has the potential to become a legacy. You know, what are your thoughts on that? And why do you think some entrepreneurs shy away from taking this sort of approach?
Well, I think number one, we both know that, you know, to be an entrepreneur, you need to have a certain level of ego and sort of chutzpah and bulletproof kind of sense about you to actually be an entrepreneur. And so part of that often leads you to a kind of an individual endeavor. So the solo entrepreneur is obviously very real. I do also think this is cultural. So we find in places like the US particularly where atomization of the individual has been a kind of a very clear and very definitive marketing strategy for decades and decades and decades, that kind of funnels that way. I tend to think, and I have always, again, as you know, tended to say, actually, you know, you may have come up with the idea, but, you know, I did the data recently. We come up with like 70,000 ideas a year. So, like, who cares about ideas?
What was your process to reduce that to a number?
I don't know. I just did a whole lot of research for something. I was speaking at something. I really want to understand this. Like, we have these, the sort of neuroscience is very advanced these days, but I always said
an entrepreneur comes up with 70,000 a week, no doubt. I'd say that's
yeah
a day. Within the course of an all hands team meeting,
apparently they're like fleeting thoughts, they're not always ideas, right? But you get the general gist, right? Which is a lot. There's a lot, and only some people have the mindset and the kind of bulletproofness and the discipline. And then, but I always said, it's never just you. So it is the garage band. It is the band. You know, there's not many singers just sitting by themselves in the garage. It's usually a band. So I always knew, it was like one of my superpowers was go find the people that have got the skills that I don't have. Even when I was 18 and I was breaking into service stations and turning them into drop-in centers, I found people who had the tools to actually break open the gates, the bulk cutters. I found the people that could bring all the food in. You know, I always built the team. It's like just absolutely fundamental and basic to me. It's like the woman who came to our house with her child and she needed a little village just to nurture and look after her so she could go and do the thing that she needed to do then come back. And the village protected the children. So it's never ever made sense to me ever. And no story have I ever believed that anybody really said I did it on my own. And if they did, I sincerely doubt it on every level. So I think that is kind of my going in, which is extremely important. And so the other thing is I hate the word holding space. I don't know where it came from. But what FYA did was create at least the kind of, before there were platforms, before there was even social media, it did create this kind of, you know, this space where people could come and have a go. And, you know, we always try to just have a go. And I always said, you're going to do 10 things, don't worry about it. You're 18, you're 22, like it's fine. Yeah. And so before all the books were written about fail forward and fail fast and lean in, another thing that I've like literally cancelled out of my language, we were doing it because we just understood common humanity. We understood what it means to actually support each other, like really basic fundamental things that didn't need social media platforms. They didn't need new books that were, you know, self-help along weird lines with two line, you know, hashtag headings. You just needed to be there for each other. And that's what I saw. And honestly, I had so little to do with that. It's just the people that turned up for each other, had each other's backs, went on the journey together, learnt together. It honestly, it's magic when you can see that happen in whatever context, anywhere, as you know.
Yeah. Team was one of the things on my list. You know, that I remember was a lesson that you imparted quite firmly, and I think it definitely became a point of reflection. You know, the difference between someone calling themselves an entrepreneur, but they maybe, you know, I don't know, a solo consultant or a coach, versus someone that has really the perspective that it takes to build a company and to build a team from, you know, 5 to 30 to 50 to 100, and depending on your industry, maybe to 1,000 or 10,000. These are very different kind of mindsets and skills. And I'm sure you've seen many examples of where maybe an entrepreneur has gotten in their own way of being able to build a strong team around them. And I'm curious, kind of, you know, your thoughts on that, any advice or perspective, especially as a team begins scaling. We're going through it at the moment. We have 30, and no doubt we'll scale probably to 50 this year. And then I hope next year it's like 100 to 200. And at every juncture, this is like radical differences in how you have to operate a team, the systems you have to build, what project management looks like, you know, who you have to be and how well you need to know what to be involved in and what not to be involved in. I definitely have friends who are entrepreneurs that struggle with, you know, that self-awareness to know where their strengths are and when they're overstepping or not overstepping, or even sometimes with my senior leaders, watching them grow teams and see the ways that they struggle or don't struggle is very interesting.
Yeah, and not stepping in and, like, telling them what to do.
Yeah.
I mean, we've all been there, and I've also failed many times on this as well. I mean, I think, you know, my first hires have always been COOs, because I just knew that I was just never going to be operational. I'm just never going to be operational. So, you know, and places where I, you know, should have maybe left before, you know, founder syndrome is a very real thing. And I've been one of those people who had to have the next thing to go on to in order to keep moving. Whereas
it's like a relationship addict, but with
exactly, because I just couldn't, you know, I couldn't just like quit and go to the beach or whatever. It's just never going to be, that's not my mindset. I could never be that person. Because I'm, you know, I'm an autodidact. I also learn by the experience. You know, I kind of live by T.S. Eliot's, you know, you can have the experience but miss the meaning. So that is like tattooed on the inside of my eyelids, you know. Don't have the experience and miss the meaning, like capture the meaning, understand. So, and that's to me by kind of learning and being in the you know, the trenches or in the valley of death or coming out of it every time. So, and I've been through all of that many, many, many times. But founder syndrome is real. Founders can stay around as long as they know how to get out of their own way. And, you know, and, you know, as you know, in our world, our day-to-day lives right now even are just like, you know, full of, you know, graveyards of founders, or founders coming back from the brink, or coming back from death and back into organizations. Like, you know, there are we're scattered with like the craziest stories. So clearly this is not something that anybody gets right, or it's not something that there is a formulaic response to. I don't think ChatGPT is ever going to really tell you how to do it.
Know what it takes to build a team.
it's messy and it's murky and it's like, and it's your baby and it's like, you know, so I think that you can only hope for self-awareness, a high level of EQ and a high level of IQ to actually know what, you know, where you need to be. I also know that at about 150 people, and this is kind of well researched in organizations, everything changes and the whole structure and the way that you work has to change. It's much more distributed leadership. And so I think there's many interesting things. And now I think that everyone's got a co-pilot. So you don't have 150 employees, you've got 300.
That's true.
And probably they've also got five each. So you've probably
and then the company second brain as well, which is
then you've got the digital twin for your whole company. So, you know, you're dealing with a lot. So you better have a really rock star team set of, you know, senior team set of advisors.
Right.
Hopefully some that are real humans. And you know, we're entering a very, very different world where I think, you know, we'll be saying two things, because we're entering sort of co-intelligence, right? So we'll be saying, I've got X number of humans in my team and I've got X number of
agents,
augmented, you know, entities of some kind. It's going to be fun.
I mean, you were building all of these companies, obviously, pre-AI, pre-Copilot. If you were to build one of them again now, what would be the things that you would do differently with the tools that we now have available?
I mean, I'm deeply interested in humanity. I love that humans. I love that they're unpredictable, that they can go in any direction, that mm-hmm. they're reactive instead of mindful, that they, you know, that they do crazy things, that they mm-hmm. sometimes forget that humans are humans and that they have feelings and lives and stories and
baggage.
Yeah, and that they also are fragile and they're vulnerable, but they're also strong and powerful. I love that. So I feel like I'm always going to be a human first person, is going to be probably my going into whatever. And that's still, you know, the next thing that I'm building now is exactly the same. It's human first. You know, we're looking at, I've gone to the other end. I'm going cradle to grave now. and I'm going, you know, as well as still working around young people and youth development and what's going to happen for young people in education, learning and work, I'm also very interested in longevity and how we're going to close the health span, lifespan gap. And I'm sort of, you know, but in all that, it's human first. You know, I walk into a physical place that I've built called Be Well. I interact with people. I hear their stories. I relate to them as humans. I don't pull out an app and say, oh, I can just quickly get a prescription for you for that. Yep. Of course, AI is built into what we do, but I'm interested in human first. I completely understand the capability of AI, and also I completely understand that I don't know the capability of AI. I have no idea. Nobody does. Mm-hmm. So I get all that, but I get how things like In Truth can be an amazing complement and an amazing insight gatherer, but I don't want it to replace sitting down and having the murky, messy, real, impactful, aha, magical moments. I just can't see it ever taking away that, and I don't want it to, really.
Yeah, well, we're going to make sure that's not what happens. It is actually an enhancer of those conversations and enables, if nothing else, a deeper vocabulary that actually allows you to have those messy conversations with even more depth and messiness.
Yeah.
Once you have more language
I think that's the thing, right? I think the thing that I definitely see in the next generation of young people, I see two things. One is, you know, high levels of anxiety and loneliness and isolation mixed with high levels of actual computational skills, you know, mm-hmm. and actual discernment and understanding what is going on in the world and trying to work out how to think about that and how to, you know, work with it in the mm-hmm. sense of it's kind of we are where we are. You can't go back and we can only go forward. So I see these two things going on, and I think the ability to communicate exactly what you said with better clarity and with a better sense of kind of understanding and awareness is probably going to be one of the key skills or capabilities we're going to carry forward. And we really, really want to develop that probably in ways that were definitely never developed in my generation, maybe not even in yours, but definitely in the next generation.
Yeah, and this is, again, something I wanted to ask your perspective on, you know, our chief of science, as an example, shares a lot about the phenomenon that happened in 2010, where every generation up until then, grandchildren had a higher IQ than their grandparents. Mm-hmm. And then in 2010, IQ started to decrease. and it was, the same timing as the introduction of the smartphone, you know, and basically when you understand it from Kaushik's perspective, you know, he is looking at it through kind of a neuroscience and evolutionary lens, that up until this time, we had to literally hold more information in our head. Like the amount of information that we had to hold in our head started to decrease when we could outsource all of those answers. Mm. And as that has gone through kind of the last, say, 15 years, and now we're introducing LLMs where literally, you know, people are spending hours having a conversation with ChatGPT and using it for all kinds of things, including the number one use, which is mental health support, which to our team is insane, but just speaks to the need, right? And the level of access, which is superior to anything our health system has been able to match. And that's what you end up with. But the fear that we have as a team that this will actually result in underdeveloped personalities, because we have generations now that don't have the feedback, they don't have the resilience to deal with confrontation, rejection, hard conversations, that convenience is at an all-time high, you know, and how do you see these factors shaping Gen Z and Gen Alpha?
Well, I don't think we know enough yet, actually. So I think we're just at the front end of genuinely trying to understand the research. You know, MIT came out with a bit of research that was then refuted within a week by a whole lot of people. So every time there's a bit of research, it says, oh, we're dumbing down kids by, you know, their use of all these tools, and here's a, you know, here's some research we did on 64 people. And then another piece comes out and says, no, that's not true. So I don't think that we're anywhere near actually genuinely understanding. And however, I do think it's important that we do. You know, I know in health, for instance, now when a baby is born in some parts of Australia, you can opt in to get a full, complete DNA kind of reading on everything. And that DNA reading now can literally tell you whether your child is going to be prone to depression. It can also tell you whether they have anything in their DNA or genetic history that relates to violence. They can also tell what kind of learner that they might be. So there is now information at scale and at depth that we would never, ever, ever have had. To me, it's like, wow, that's incredible. It's also incredibly dangerous, because imagine if you as a three-year-old was kind of stereotyped.
Totally.
Because here's the report that we got when you were born.
Yeah.
Says this, because, you know, who knows where we'd all be, Nick.
Yeah, exactly. We're shaping people's destiny. I mean, think about all of the, like, undiagnosed ADD and neurodivergence amongst, like, the generation of people that we were just talking about. I mean, all of us are definitely on some kind of spectrum, but not wearing that label allowed us to push beyond those limits and actually, you know, live normal, powerful lives. Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that.
Yeah, and I'm with you on that. I'm in two minds. I can see the value if you really do have a learning, you know, environment that is just not conducive to you in any way, shape or form, and actually makes you ill or depressed or sick. Sure. And then I can also equally see how being told that you're something and given the label actually frames, as you say, your destiny. You take on the persona of that, and that can be positive, but it could also equally be negative. So I'm very sure at school today being given a bunch of labels. I can't even think how many I would have had. And I'm absolutely positive it would have. Now, it might have given me a better learning experience at school, because my learning experience was very bad and zero, and I didn't learn anything and I failed all the time.
Yeah.
That could have been something. So, yeah, maybe I might have ended up with a better academic record and some university thing, but what would it have done to the kind of resilience and the kind of chutzpah and the kind of drive I had to actually make my own way? with the labels on top of me would have been, as I got enough labels as it was, by the way, from my parents and family, let alone, you know, clinical labels. So I'm in really two minds. I can definitely see where it's very much helped people, very much so, and get the help and support they need. And I can also see where it could. So, you know, how do you create the kind of environment, again, where people can come from a sense of their, like, in all these, if they said to everybody, not the DNA check that said, here's your child's propensity for violence or depression, but said, here's the strengths that are, like, absolutely, we can see them. And, like, these are the things that would be phenomenal to develop and help your child develop. Like, that would be incredible. Like, we can almost tell you where they're going to, like, their superpowers could be. And it won't always be perfect and they won't always be, you know, amazing at these things. But whereas the propensity and which will affect insurance, of course, is like, here's where they're going to go bad. Yeah. Here's where it's going to cost the government money. Here's where it's going to cost
insurance. You need to make sure that these companies aren't unethically, you know, selling this data to insurance companies. It's like, yeah, we think about that a lot because you can set the terms, right? Like, insurance companies want our data, but the line that we are going to hold is, you know, we'll sell you the data with the permission of the person on one condition, and that's everyone starts their policy with the same at the same amount, the same dollar amount, and through healthy behaviors they can get deductions rather than the you know, premiums being determined by historical data, because that is, you know, seriously dystopic. But you raise, I think, an even more important point here that I would understand as we have unprecedented levels of insight through data without the wisdom to know, you know, what an appropriate thing to do with that data is, how to talk about that data, a question I ask a lot at In Truth with the team is, how is this going to be socialized? Like, we don't know how this data is going to be socialized yet. And we need very wise people, in my opinion, you know, leading the charge. But unfortunately, we have a lot of intelligent people that aren't necessarily kind of wise or spiritually mature leading the charge. And I would say that that's not a perfect solution, but it would get us a hell of a lot further than trying to set these rigid rules around how these things work, which just in our current kind of economic structure isn't going to work, because there's always going to be, you know, these pressures.
A workaround as well, isn't there, as we know. Always work around, even under the existing guidelines, or there's, or, you know, some entrepreneur or some actor or some kind is going to find the workaround. I mean, I think it was very interesting. There was a bit of research out last week about Gen Zs, and it was about AI and their use of AI and so on. They're not actually worried about AI, which is interesting. The only thing they were worried about and that they said that they wanted was ethical guidelines in place.
Yeah, you know, we just
like, you know, if there's ethical guidelines, we're okay with it.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting, right?
Doesn't surprise me. I was thinking of you actually last week. We hosted, or the week before, we hosted a youth advocacy group through Prevention United at our Sydney office. And, you know, we're thinking about starting a parliamentary friends for youth and AI so that they have we should talk about that in sidebar conversation, but so that youth have a voice in shaping some of these ethical considerations around how data is regulated. And I was really amazed, you know, there was the youngest young leader in the room was 16, and I think the oldest was maybe 24, something like that. And they, on one hand, had so many insightful things to share, as we know, you know, and so many amazing things that we're going to take and hopefully try to drive some advocacy and policy around these ideas. But on the other hand, one of the things that struck me so much is we had a conversation around echo chambers, and one of the young leaders who was 16 said, you know, echo chambers have become such a reality that I feel like I don't even know how to have a conversation with a 17-year-old or a 15-year-old, because the influence around the demographics has become so insular and specific and driven by echo chambers. And I mean, that to me is such a tragedy. When you think about like youth development, right, and the development of personality and leadership, the ability to be friends with people who are younger, be friends with people who are older, have conversations, you know, and like I can have a conversation with a 70-year-old and not even feel the age difference. I can have a conversation, you know, with, I thought, with a 16-year-old and not feel the age difference. But now we're hitting this tipping point, right, where echo chambers are driving beliefs and cultural influence that once upon a time it was like a whole generation would watch The Simpsons. That would be the cultural influence, you know. It's like targeted, very specific messaging that's keeping, you know, the bandwidth of an age bracket of months insular against their peers. And to me, that was a really like heartbreaking thing. And one of the things that I wanted to get them to get out of the day was, hey, look at us. You know, we have three generations in the room. We're all able to have dynamic conversations. You know, you can live beyond the echo chamber of your influence.
And I'm interested in what the influence actually is. So, because again, you know, I'm always very curious. And as you know, with me, Nick, everything's contestable, right? I never believe anything that I'm told. It's been my way of thinking about the world, because I also know that, particularly in areas of education and future of work where I am, spending part of my life at least, the most significant influences for young people about choices they make about what they're going to do after school are still their parents. And for better or worse, by the way, sometimes for worse, because their parents' ambitions are not actually at a level that actually we would want the young person's. But so although they're in echo chambers, they're in echo chambers about specific things, because the algorithm has locked them into an echo chamber and is feeding them, right? So they're like, I'm a bird, just feed me. And that's what's happening. And so the main thing is to tell them that that's what's happening and for them to get that awareness so that they can make decisions. But in bigger life decisions, they're still actually turning to their family. Their family's very important. They are still also living at home longer with their family. That's still going on as well as Gen Ys all the way through. So the damn cost of living and so that intergenerational thing is still very real. Parents of, like, you know, my generation, your generation, in that generally, and then the next generation is X, and so, like, I'm X boomer, like, crossover, and so my children are Gen Y, and then the next group are X parents and they've got Z children. They say their relationships with their parents are way better than, say, the relationships my generation and Gen X with their parents. So there are some amazing things that are still
The millennials who are giving birth to Gen Alpha is going to be an interesting case study.
Yeah, well, I've got a couple of those going on, and they're like also very
grandchildren.
They're very connected, very connected. Like, so
very emotionally available.
Very emotionally available, very tired because they're too old to have children. But no, they're not. They're fine. But I think, you know, I think that we just want to make sure that we don't get captured by, you know, I always say I follow kind of the trend lines, not the headlines. There are a million headlines all day, every day, as we know. Mm-hmm. But when you unpack it all and you say, well, who do you actually talk to and who do you go to if you're in trouble? And, yes, you might go to ChatGPT, but in the end, you know, this is why parents still drive their children in the middle of the night to parties so that they can talk to them in the car.
Yeah.
Like, that's the most profound moment. And I still hear young parents today.
If you're in San Francisco, you're in a Waymo, actually.
That's a problem to me. Yeah. That's a problem. You're taking away that opportunity.
Totally.
The most important conversation that you might have all week is Friday night at midnight with your, or listening to your daughter and her girlfriends talk for half an hour about what happened.
Yeah.
Which enables you to have a conversation for the next half hour with your daughter or son. So I feel like there are many moments that we don't want to, you know, have the experience miss the meaning. Many moments that are deeply human, and we need to understand those. We need to cherish them. They need to be seen as sacred. And we mustn't let a narrative about the echo chamber or the algorithm overtake us, because it absolutely 100% could. It could, and that's a very real, but I want to contest it and I want to push back against it, because the loneliness epidemic is the thing that I'm really very, very interested in. And that loneliness epidemic, those people who feel deeply lonely are online a lot of the time.
Yeah. Totally.
It's not fulfilling that human.
It's not a solution. You know, you turn to GPT because you're lonely, it just exacerbates the loneliness.
Like thinking for 1 second that ChatGPT is a real person. And I have found myself saying please and thank you, although I know it doesn't matter, because I'm being programmed.
Those data centers, that's millions of dollars, Jan, in energy.
I'll have to stop. I didn't do it, and then I thought I was being rude, and then I started doing it, and I'm like, no, I don't need to do this.
Not a human. Damn it.
Not a human. Anyway, so everything, we need to hold, I think we just need to hold, hold quite lightly a lot of what is washing over in the tsunami, and just like try to like dig for where is the real gold, where are the real experiences, the real meanings of things that we're meant to be understanding here?
Actual connection.
I think, you know, you did that at the beginning with Love Out Loud. That was your whole premise. We talked about that right beginning of this, you know, community. There is no replacement.
Agreed. There's just
no replacement for it.
Yeah, that's the 1,000% the philosophy and thinking behind everything that we're still building. And I think it is actually if you want to think about it through the lens of like sustainability, I think it's the only truly organic and sustainable premise to build anything on. Mm-hmm. And even if we did go down sort of, you know, Robocop path where AI takes over, because it's inorganic, it won't sustain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just hope that we maintain human life in the process of something that would inevitably disintegrate, because it isn't, you know, organic life, and that's the only thing that will prevail. Mm-hmm. But this is going to be my last question, then we'll do a bit of a plug for Be Well. But you're bringing up something, sort of a conversation that's quite dear to my heart, and I think one that my generation don't have enough, and that's around family. And I feel like millennial gens are kind of they're definitely the latest generation to have kids. The ones that are having kids, they're the most resistant to having kids, and this is something that I feel is, you know, quite tragic and very kind of, you know, just going to lead us to not a great path. Even when you look at countries like Japan, who are producing well under the replacement rate, like, what are your perspectives on this? Why do you think for the first time this is a thing? Obviously we can say cost of living, this, that, but what do you think is really going on?
I think eco-anxiety, actually. When I work around the world, when I work around the world, and obviously, by the way, this sort of phenomena of not having children in Gen Ys is, I think, basically a Western thing, democracy thing, but a lot of it is linked to eco-anxiety. There's a lot of why would I, you know, bring children onto this planet at this point in time. That's a very, very, that trumps cost of living.
Wow.
I remember when I was younger, and it was, you know, for my parents, it was like the threat of the nuclear, you know, everyone thought that the bombs were going to be dropped all over the world, and that's why people wouldn't have children. You know, there was a whole, so this isn't the first time
in
history that there's been that sense of, you know, it's too fearful, we're too fearful, or there's too much risk, or we, you know, this sense of loss, it's the loss aversion, right? And so I think it's really, really interesting. Regardless, because of increases in health, because of increases in contraception, because of
increased pressure to have kids isn't
it's not the same anyway. And, you know, we always said, actually, if you educated all the girls and women in the world, A, the world would be a better place, but also population would go down, and that's definitely true. Yeah. Because, you know, that's not your only option, to be perfectly frank, is to kind of have children. So there are a lot of good things to be said about having choice. And I think that it's about that. It's about choice. And so the main thing is, if you do want to have children, are the systems in place in order for that to happen? And if you don't, you know, is everybody accepting of your choices? You know, for whatever the reasons are. But I do think eco-anxiety is a very, very big stressor in a couple of generations right now.
Yeah, that's really, like, interesting and somewhat, you know, surprising, but I guess also not. It's like kind of is, but isn't. And I agree that when a young woman is faced with sort of their life and they can see more than sort of a traditional path, then yeah. And you know, do you have, obviously you think choice is a good thing, but do you think about the perspective issues with that and what we need to do as solutions? For I think a lot of females like still don't believe that they can have it all. And I'll give an example which actually really like quite shook me. I was at a conference in New York a couple of years ago, and there was a guy that was presenting on the artificial womb, so the creation of an artificial womb. And I was like really confronted by this, and not in a good way. I was like, we should not be like messing with literally the most natural process. Like, you know, it's literally
human
life. Like, let's not try to like take that away. And you know, it was a guy presenting, and I think he was one of the co-founders of the company. So I thought for sure the other women at the conference, to which there were very few because it was a longevity tech conference, longevity DSAC conference. But I was just speaking my mind, sitting around a table with them, and said, you know, isn't it crazy? Like, we're just trying to replace literally everything human. And the women, who were probably in their late 40s, 50s, said, no, we think that it's great. And I was like, what are you talking about? And they were like, well, women get told all the time that we can have it all, but the reality is, if you have, you know, a career through your 20s and 30s, it's very, very hard to have it all. And this is a way that, you know, maybe we could actually truly have it all. And I was really taken aback by this mindset. Like, I understand it, but for women to be at this place where they're sort of just willing to outsource it, willing to outsource growing a baby, you know, in favor of their career, was really like a wake-up call to where the world is actually at as it relates to some of these more organic human elements.
I saw that presentation too, because I saw it at there's a lab in South Africa, like a group, an organization that were doing this. I saw it at the Singularity conference a couple of years ago as well. So, and they're also linked to designer babies, where, you know, that's very real, that you can design
the genetics.
Design your baby now. So I don't know, is this all just an extension of choice?
This is, I guess, the root of my question.
This is my question. And at what point, you know, I think lots of people try to put ethical overplay on it. So there's a whole lot of questions, right? And I don't know what the answers are. I think it's very, very, I think we're definitely going into that realm. And I think it's, again, very interesting to have the open discussions. I think for me, the question on all of this is who gets to make the decisions, have the discussions, put the regulations in place. And, you know, we've seen over and over again in history, for instance, women in relation to their bodies have been the last people that have had something to say or been allowed to have something to say. So, again, you would just not want that for the future. It's the same as I want students to help design the future of education that makes sense for them and the world they're in. It's like, to me, that kind of the core premise of agency in your own life and in the decisions that are being made and not to you, about you, on your behalf, is just a fundamental tenet. Like, it's a going in. And of course you want good information. Of course you want to make sure everybody's got good, precise, excellent information to make decisions. But I think we're in a different era now where we just cannot do what we did in the past, which was even outsource the decisions to make the decision about that.
I know.
That's worry about companies that are doing that, right? They're just plowing ahead.
Yeah.
You know, governments have got no chance at this point in time, in my view.
No.
So we are a global corporation, and that's a really, you know, that's we're in a very interesting time.
We need better philanthropists, Jan. That's the we actually do. We need long-term funding assets. That's, you know, big part of the answer, and more socially minded and artistic thinkers, I think, working in tech to break the otherwise very linear way of divergent but kind of one-track minded way of understanding how to build tech companies, which at the moment is based on extraction and not on human flourishing. Like everything, which, you know, the next thing in the firing line is our physiology, our biological data, is the commodity. So I'd love you to speak a little bit about Be Well and give a plug to anyone in Australia or specifically Melbourne, and then we can wrap up.
Yeah, well, we set up Be Well a few years ago out of in COVID and then out of COVID. Say that again.
That was your COVID baby.
COVID baby. Exactly. A few years before that, my husband had a heart attack, and sort of very scary because harking back to my father, sort of similar age, and didn't die though, thank goodness, of his heart attack, unlike my father. But he had a kind of a wake up call and went, "Oh, if I'm gonna get to 60 in one piece, I better reclaim my health and fitness." And he had been very healthy and very fit. He'd been a marathon runner and a triathlete. It wasn't like he sort of sat around doing a Homer Simpson for his whole life. But he definitely and so we started talking about that. I'd always had a really strong interest. I've been like a yogi my whole life. I've always sort of been focused on mind, body, kind of spirit kind of stuff, and been a runner and done heaps of things. I'm a very intermittent and get bored easily exerciser, so I have to do lots of different things. And then we just thought about start doing the research on A, the aging population, B, the level of ill health, and then this kind of gap between health span and lifespan. So we're living 15 years longer thanks to technology and thanks to scientific and medical breakthroughs, but actually the quality of life in those last 15 years, very poor. And so who wants to live a very poor quality of life for your last 15 years? It's a long time, right? So we're living to 85 and people are going from 71 or 2 to 85 on a really downward slope. So we said we need to do something about this. And so let's find something. And we went around and we were already going to yoga here and Pilates there and recovery there and physio there. And we said, why doesn't this exist in one place under one roof? And it just didn't. So we said, let's build it and let's focus on people who are over 40 who want to reclaim their health and their well-being. You see it as a whole, us as a whole system, body, mind, spirit, not disaggregated and fragmented. And let's build that. And, of course, you know, from everything we talked about here, community was always going to be very, very important, and community has become central to this, to Be Well. It is an amazing community, and people have found renewed focus, energy, life force, but also friends and community, kind of got back so much of what they felt they'd lost in sort of relentless career kind of trajectories and chases, and motherhood and parenthood and all the things that you kind of lose in that kind of really intense period of your life. And so it's been amazing. And also we're just now collecting data. We're 3 years old, just starting to collect data on sort of change over time, which has been fantastic, seeing people's like genuine physical, emotional, and you know, kind of sense of self transform. It's been just brilliant, and the data's kind of showing it. So super excited to see where we go. We're still at the front end. Longevity is still a kind of a new idea. It's got. I just saw the other day a longevity conference in the US that was for people who have got $30 million or plus. So there's something very wrong again. We're just doing
it's an elite. It's an elite
all over again.
Yeah, elite.
Sure. And it's, you know, men who are like 40 who are trying to run it. And whereas where we are the kind of we are our own target group. And I think that's been something that's brought us a lot of integrity and genuine curiosity, but yeah. also trust in mm-hmm. our research and also our integrity about why we're doing what we're doing. And I think that needs to happen in business more rather than less. Of course, we will use a bunch of the tools as they come online and hopefully in truth. And, you know, we want to be a kind of a lab as well. And we've got people who are kind of interested in being, who are trying out new things. That's why they're there. They want to be better, healthier, happier. They do want to throw their kids around at 80, their grandkids around at 80. They do want to be able to put a, you know, something up on a shelf or get something off a shelf. And really everything still comes down to lifestyle. Like all our research and every bit of research, whether you're listening to David Sinclair or Peter Attia or any of them, Jennifer Garrison, still the only thing we really know about is that lifestyle is your best medicine. So getting information about your lifestyle and how you improve it is still your best medicine. Yes, there are people doing crazy things and injecting themselves with their 16-year-old son's plasma and all that, but that's on the kind of the sort of outer edge of the testing and the limits of our physiology. But I'm interested in the integration, not the fragmentation. I don't want to see our physical body separated from our emotional state or our spiritual state. And I'm interested in how we use the tools to help get the insight to, you know, build our kind of lifestyle, our lifestyle as our medicine. It's the best chance we've got right now.
Amen. I just want to stress the extreme importance of making sure that longevity as an industry, but also as, I don't know, an idea is democratized, because the dark side of it not being right is very, very wealthy people that have access to extreme life extension techniques mm-hmm. combined with super intelligence and mm-hmm. the rest of us. So,
yeah, exactly.
You know, from my deepest, you know, parts of my heart as someone working in tech, what you're doing really matters. And I would encourage anyone that, you know, just is interested in health or want to feel better to understand that with modern day research, there's so much, you know, that we now can do, and behaviors and hacks and habits that we can engage in that actually do result in better lifespan and better health span, to your point.
Yeah.
And, you know, eventually to be able to close that gap completely so that every year we have on the planet's a healthy year.
Yeah.
It's awesome, Jan. Well, this is no surprises that this has been an enlightening conversation. I got to learn some new things about you too, which I'm very grateful for.
It's great. Thank you so much. I've loved these reverse conversations that we've had, and I've loved our reconnecting. It's been awesome.
Yeah.
It's cherished. I cherish it.
Thanks. Yeah, me too, John. Yeah, any final message to anyone that's spent the last hour and a half listening to our conversation?
I doubt that they will have, but
they will have.
I know. I think everyone's. I just, you know, find the time to find yourself. I'm very very interested in how we're all going to show up, and I think we kind of need to be very intentional about that at this mm-hmm. stage of our existence and humanity.
Yeah, amen to that. Thanks for coming on the show, Jan.
Thanks, Nick.